Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A pleasure to see you all on this budget night. Welcome to the Spectator Autumn Budget Briefing of 2017. When was the last time a budget took place in this country when the leaves were turning brown?
Long time ago.
Yeah, I got that bit.
1996
is the correct answer. You were clearly watching the BBC's budget special this afternoon. Ever since then, it's been a spring budget, but we're now, for reasons that are still a mystery to me, we're back in the autumn budget again, which is fine. We're delighted to see so many of you here tonight. I have come hot foot from the BBC studios after some interesting interviews with the Chief Secretary and the Shadow Chancellor. James has come hot foot from the House of Commons, where he's had the inside briefings from the Treasury, the Chancellor, and various others. And Fraser has been monitoring everything that's been going on today, doing the usual number crunching, and he'll present all that. It's almost 6 hours since the Chancellor sat down, having delivered his 7,843-word budget speech. Almost 6 hours. And so far, it hasn't unraveled. This means 10 Downing Street will regard it as a major achievement. And job done. Of course, it is early days. It could have unraveled in places by the morning or even by the weekend. But for the moment, it hasn't unraveled. The headlines tomorrow, a lot of them will concentrate on the abolition of stamp duty for first-time buyers for houses under 300,000. It's quite a significant, small step, but significant in its own way. There is no region outside of London in which average house prices are anywhere near 300,000. So for 85%, at least, of first-time buyers, they're going to benefit from this change. And even in London, you'll benefit, even if you buy the houses of 500,000, you'll benefit from no stamp duty on the first 300,000. So that's the kind of retail offer that will probably get some of the headlines tomorrow. Downing Street tells us tonight that it's polling really well, so well that they've written an article for Mrs. May, which is going to be in one of the newspapers tomorrow, saying how much this will do to help young people get on the housing ladder again. So that's fine, but let's look at some more important things. The real story of this budget is the Office for Budget Responsibility's downgrading of British economic growth. Now, the OBR was established by the Conservatives to provide independent forecasts on which the government would then have to base its tax and spend fiscal position. Now, in March of this year, the OBR told us that the economy would grow this year by 2%. That, I think, is only about 6 or 7 months ago. It's now telling us the economy this year will grow by only 1.5%. It doesn't mean it's right. The OBR has got these things wrong. Even this late in the game, it's called, in November 2013, it called the growth rate for 2013 and still managed to be out by a factor of 50%, even though there was only 1 month left to report. So it's a special genius takes you to manage to do that. But the government has no choice but to follow it. The government has made the rules itself and it has no choice but to follow these things. That's the Robin Hood butler coming in there. So more important than just the downgrade for this year is it was already quite gloomy about next year and the year after. And it's now become even more gloomy. It's now gone down from 1.5 to 1.4, then to 1.3, then the following year another 1.3, and then it begins to turn up a little bit. What this means is that the OBR is forecasting that this economy is set to be in the slow lane for the foreseeable future, and that the trend rate of growth, which is the rate economists reckon the economists can grow without rising inflation, which used to be over 2%, is now around 1.5, 1.6%. Now, if this is true, this is very serious. It's quite a step change in the course of this economy. And of course, it has been a major factor in the Chancellor having to redo his budget arithmetic and his fiscal position going forward to the years coming up. And it may be true, but it also may not. Because the fundamental reason they've made these changes is that they have accepted that their constant predictions on productivity have always overestimated productivity in this country. There are new people doing these sums now in the OBR, and they've decided to be much more rigorous. And they've said that because our productivity is not growing anything like expected, our economic growth will therefore not be anything like expected. I have a slight problem with this. I have two problems with this that I would simply flag up, which the government could do nothing about because, as I say, it's mandated to accept the forecasts of the OBR. I have two problems. One is I'm not sure they know how to measure productivity. I know how to measure productivity in a manufacturing economy. I know how to measure productivity at the Range Rover car factory. I even know how to measure productivity at the Rolls-Royce aerospace engine factory. I don't know how to measure productivity at the Spectator. I mean, I know it's pretty low, as you can tell. but I don't know how to measure it. I don't know how you measure productivity at Old Mutual. I don't know how you measure it at Aberdeen Asset. I don't know how you measure it at many of the major service economies. As James was saying to me earlier today, if I book my next flight online here to go to New York or France or wherever, it shows up as zero economic activity in the public accounts. But if I find, if one still exists, a Thomas Cook office to go and book my ticket there, that shows up as economic activity and counts towards Thomas Cook's productivity. So one isn't measured at all, though it's highly productive for me to be able to book it myself, highly productive, because it gives me more time to do other things, but it doesn't show up. But if I do it the old-fashioned way, to Thomas Cook, it shows up. So I think the productivity figures are suspect. And I think in a British economy in which we have pretty close to full employment, in a sense, because we have gone so low in unemployment, to some extent, productivity will reflect that. Unlike France, where productivity is very high, but 25% of kids are unemployed. Now, where do you want to live? Do you want to live in a country where nominally the productivity seems low, but now almost everybody who wants a job can get a job? Or in a country where 250 cars are burnt every Friday night because it's now the national sport in cities across France, because 25% of the kids have nothing to do? So that's my one reservation on that. My second is the link between productivity growth and economic growth. I'm not sure it's that clear. We've had low productivity for quite some time, but quite robust growth. And I'm not sure that the OBR is right to say that because productivity growth, by their measure, is low, that therefore economic growth is going to be low. As I say, they may be right, but they may also have badly underestimated it. Now, the consequence of this has now been a major change in the government's fiscal position. Because what has happened is that because the government's had to accept these forecasts, the deficit does not come down so quickly because the economy is not growing so quickly, tax revenues are not being generated so fast, and therefore the deficit stays bigger. But Mr. Hammond has done more than that. He, in addition to accepting that, has actually increased spending. He has opened the taps in a number of ways, from the NHS to ameliorating the introduction of universal credit, to more money for infrastructure spending, to more money for housing. Across a wide range of things, spending is now going to increase, which, of course, adds to the size of the deficit. And the consequence of both the structural issue of productivity, as the OBR sees it, and the Chancellor's decision to spend more money, is that deficit reduction, though it continues, does not continue at the same pace that he envisaged even back in March. And when politicians fail to make their targets, what they do is they reinvent a new target and say, no, we never really meant to hit that target anyway. This is the target that matters. And the government today regards the budget as a watershed because the metric it now wants us to keep an eye on is debt as a percentage of GDP. Now, if you look at the Red Book figures today, this year is when debt to GDP peaks. Now, debt is our national debt, the accumulated debt of all these deficits we've run over the years. And of course, it rose substantially after the crash and has continued to rise under this government because the government has continued to run deficits. And what it's saying now is that what matters is that the debt is now beginning, will now begin to fall and continue to fall as a percentage of GDP. What politicians will actually say, what Liz Truss, the Chief Secretary, tried to say today, is that the debt is now falling. It's not now falling. It's falling as a percentage of GDP. In absolute terms, the debt is still rising because we're still running a deficit every year. But this is quite an important metric because my own view is that although the deficit will now come down more slowly, if the bond markets see that debt is nevertheless falling as a percentage of GDP, the bond markets will be quite comfortable with that. And there's certainly no sign today that the bond markets are discombobulated by the greater fiscal profligacy of the Chancellor. So I think that's one of the moves. The second is that the surplus, this desire to hit a surplus in fiscal policy, is gone, over, finished. Don't talk about it, not in front of the children. This was a target that Mr. Osborne set in 2010 and said we'd balance the budget by 2015. When we had palpably failed to do that in 2015, he said he would balance it in 2020. When Mr. Hammond became Chancellor and saw quite clearly that was never going to happen, he said 2025. Today, when we spoke to government about when will we hit surplus, the answer was, excuse me, what was that? It's just kicked into the long grass. It's no longer a target. And by the way, in my view, economically, it doesn't matter whether you have a surplus or debt of 1%, or deficit of 1% of GDP matters very little. The idea is that they will now try to get the deficit to come down to around 1 or 2% of GDP, but manage things so that the overall debt continues downwards against GDP. The consequence is that in the budget forecast for the ongoing period for the next 3 to 4 years, the deficit overall will be £25 billion bigger than it was even in March. So it's a change of fiscal policy. It's not the end of austerity, because even though the government is upping infrastructure spending, that its deficit reduction program has slowed even further, that it has now kicked the concept of a fiscal surplus so far into the long grass, it's now irrelevant. The one figure floating around Whitehall tonight was it maybe 2032. Some of you won't see that. I might not see it, so I don't really care. But it's not quite the end of austerity, because there's still, even to reach this declining debt as a percentage of GDP, there is still quite a big squeeze on major spending departments, on current spending. Infrastructure spending is going to rise. Capital investment will rise. Not hugely, but it's going to rise. But to be able to do that and keep to a broad fiscal constraint, current spending is still going to be squeezed quite tightly. So it's not a remarkable budget. It's an interesting budget. I do think it's a watershed budget in some sense, in that the metrics have changed. The priorities of this government have now changed. I think the real danger is, or the real question is, are these OBR forecasts on growth right? Because if they are right, it's a pretty grim prognosis, prospectus for Britain for the next 3 or 4 years. If they're wrong, that's a different matter. But the idea that this country would cannot grow, is struggling to grow by 1.5% at a time when we have so much more to do, I think is grim in the extreme, and not the kind of country that those who voted to leave would think we should have, that, because they were hoping that this would become much more dynamic, much faster growing, much more entrepreneurial. So a lot hangs on these OBR forecasts, and we will monitor very carefully just how accurate they have turned out to be. So that's my kind of overview. I'd like now to move to Fraser, who's going to do our annual budget number crunching. Fraser.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, every single budget, I mean, the OBR gets a lot of things wrong. The productivity, of course, that is economic output divided by the number of workers. Every single time, they underestimate hugely the number of workers which this job-creating beast of an economy of ours is capable of doing. We are living right now at a time where unemployment is at its lowest since something like, 1972, I think, the year I was born. And this is what the forecasts have done so far. Look at that. Every single year, the forecasts have been completely outpaced by the actual job creation. Even the last budget, March 2017, has been outpaced by job creation. Now, the converse of this is low productivity. So when you do hear about productivity, bear that in mind. Is it better to live in a low productivity, high employment economy, or one the other way around? I mean, what this doesn't factor in as well is a social benefit of having people working rather than being on the dole. So, like Andrew, I've always been quite relaxed about productivity. You want to live in a country where companies are worrying about how they're going to find people to hire, then people are going to worry about where their job is going to come from. Unemployment has gone down like a stone. Look at that. So from 2.5 million down below 1.5 million. So much that Philip Hammond said at the weekend that there are no unemployed people on the Mars show. He wasn't quite right, but it's heading in the right direction. Now, also, remember that this budget is against the backdrop not so long ago of Brexit's predictions. So how are we now versus what the Treasury predicted would happen after the Brexit vote? You can see Osborne's two scenarios at the bottom, the shock scenario and the severe shock scenario. And then you can see what's actually happening. Today's forecast, and it's, you know, it's pretty good, really. This is not the shock we were expecting. And what you've been reading about EU nationals all returning home since the Brexit vote. Mm. Well, let's see how many EU nationals there are here. Look at that. Now, the Brexit vote is the line there. The momentum has not been dented by that Brexit. Anyway, so things are pretty good, actually. Things were. When we've got people queuing in Dover, desperate to get to Calais, then we should worry about what state our economy is in. But for now, this is, by and large, a good problem to have. And also, you know, of course, the pound has plunged, and that has put up inflation. But the inflation we read today is going to be it's going to peak at about 3%. Now, compared to where inflation has been previously, a 3% peak really is not that bad. If that is the worst fallout from the Brexit vote, then we, you know, there are far worse scenarios that could befall us. And the other thing is, you'll see the Brexit was at 3%. You know, five years ago, it was more than that. The last time the pound devalued seriously. And the pound was overvalued before the Brexit vote. If you look at the IMF, it estimated there were at the second from the right, that the pound was, broadly speaking, about sort of 8-15% overvalued, not anymore. So the other thing that Philip Hammond was able to talk to today is that the top 1%, he was able to say that they're paying now a bit, how much of the income tax burden? 28% of the income tax in this country is paid by the top 1% of earners. I mean, sure, they're earning a lot. They're earning about 13% of the income, but they're paying a lot more than that in income tax. This is what the progressive income tax policy does, which is why income inequality, according to the ONS, is at the lowest today than in 30 years. You will hear quite a lot of people tell you that we've got this terrible problem with rising inequality, but we don't. It's at the lowest for 3 decades. That's because these policies are actually working. Okay, that's the good news. Now for the bad. These were the growth forecasts we had not so long ago, March 2016. This time last year, they got a bit gloomier. Then Philip Hammond's last budget, March 2017, changed it a little bit. But now look at this. quite strict downgrades, really, the sort of strictest you see outside of a recession. This is because the OBR has decided, made a bunch of assumptions on productivity, and this, of course, will affect the national debt. Now, the nervous should look away now as I show you our debt pile. Look at that. So you'll see that the black lines represent elections. We are at about £1 trillion of national debt when the Tories first got in, or in the coalition. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. That debt pile was planning to go down, but look now, right at the end, you can see an uplift again. So what's happening now is that the Conservatives have reconciled themselves to increasing rather than decreasing debt, but importantly, never talking about that, just talking about the ratio. So as long as the debt is going up, but at a slower rate than the economy is rising, they will regard that as a result. Now, the deficit used to be the defining mission of the Conservatives, to abolish the deficit. We used to hear it would be abolished by 2015, then 2017, then 2020. And this was the plan not so long ago. Look at that. We would be negative deficit in 2019-20. In other words, the government would be taking in more than it is spending. But every single time a Tory chancellor stands up at that, that slips. So November 2016, we had it looking further away into the future. And now look at that. These are deficits that will last pretty much forevermore. Another important thing, this government is not serious about balancing the books. The books in this country were balanced in, I think, it was 2001/2, and haven't been balanced since, are unlikely to be balanced in the current trajectory. I never quite believed that George Osborne was ever going to balance the books. It's a nice thing to say to the bond markets that you're going to do in 4 or 5 years' time. But also you can see, you know, and it's funny people are talking about 2031, beyond 2 years, you shouldn't take any of these forecasts seriously. Anyway, so we are now, we used to be the fastest growth in the G8. Now we're about middle. Next year we'll be towards the end of that. But it's still, by international standards, it's a little bit slower, but not massively slower. And also, if you look at how we are, other countries, we're about keeping pace with Germany. And behind the Americas, sure, but still, compared to where we were in the crash, still ahead of France, ahead of the Eurozone, ahead of Japan, and just thank God we're not Italy. So there is, you know, things, growth is bad, but in that context, we've done quite a lot of growing. So if we're going to be growing at a slightly more normal pace, it's not quite the end of the world. Now, the OBR, is it being pessimistic? Probably. I mean, these are its forecasts. This is the independent consensus. So you can see it's being strikingly more pessimistic than most independent analysts. But these estimates are always wrong in one way or another. But this, the worst thing, perhaps, for the government is wages. You can see now this is the average wage. Look where it was. It was 100 before the crash. Look at where it is now. Now you can adjust it for CPI or RPI. Either way, we're looking at a lost decade and a half. This is where the main economic problem comes from now. There are lots of people in work, but they're in work because wages are relatively low. You can hire more people if they don't cost as much. So this is the big problem that the government has got to try to address. What to do for people who feel they haven't had a rise in a very, very long time. Of course, the OBR points the finger at productivity. You can see here the various estimates of productivity growth. And right at the end, you've got a fan. The top end of that blue fan is the pre-crisis average productivity growth, where we were heading. And the bottom end of that fan is a post-crisis average, in other words, no productivity growth at all. They've split the difference. So that's where all these downgrades come from today. They were thinking that the pre-crisis growth of productivity was an exaggeration, and this will be the new normal. We'll see. Now, the Chancellor was also saying today that Britain's going to be at the forefront of this technological revolution. And I've got my own theory about productivity. It's not that we don't have, that all the machines have come to take our jobs. It's that we've got too many humans doing jobs that machines should do. For the last sort of 10 years, we've had a limitless supply of brilliant labour. Any employer could fill their boots with incredible sorts of staff rather than invest in the sort of machinery that we're seeing used abroad. This is what Philip Hammond was saying. The world is on the brink of technological revolution. And Britain is genuinely at the forefront of this revolution. So we hear about, we imagine a dystopia here where the humans are begging for money from the machines doing our jobs. But the real situation in Britain is slightly different. Look at this, a league table of automation. And we are the worst of all of those countries there, behind Slovakia, behind Slovenia. This is for automation and manufacturing. We've got a lot of catching up to do. Now, you know, you could argue this is not a bad thing. Socially, it's good to have lots of people employed. But to me, the problem with automation is we don't have enough of it in this country, and that might be behind it. Now, the Chancellor's big promise today was more homes, 300,000 a year. Can we believe that? Well, look, when Gordon Brown promised 250,000 and the real figure was 200, it then plummeted. Politicians say this all the time. I wouldn't take it too seriously. Rather, I would believe it when I see it. And house building has been a major problem. And he's given his little stamp duty help today, which has slightly helped people outside of London buy a new house. The OBR says that the price of the houses are likely to, will go up accordingly, so the buyers won't sell, won't gain much, but the sellers will. But still, people like a tax rise. This will go down well. So the Tories find themselves locked in this kind of battle to balance the books. Historically, by the way, since 1920, the blue line is government spending, the red line is a tax take. And you can see the never-ending sort of battle to close this gap, a gap which I don't think, after today's budget, we're going to see closed under this Conservative government at all. Thank you.
Thanks, Fraser. And all these great charts, Fraser, they'll be on the Spectator Coffee House?
They will do tomorrow morning. You guys getting an exclusive look at them. Tomorrow morning, everybody else will be catching up.
It was so good to you. I can't believe it. You think Christmas was approaching. James.
So we've learned today that Philip Hammond believes in spending money to support employment, his own. Before this budget, we knew all the spending demands on him, and they were considerable. We knew there was push for more cash to prepare for Brexit, more cash for the NHS. He had to find the money to fund the deal with the DUP. He had to find the money to fund his U-turn on national insurance contributions for the self-employed. And we were all sitting there saying, he's got a real political problem. How is he going to pay for this? The short answer is he's not. He is just borrowing more. And if you talk to the Treasury tonight, they're quite clear. They've avoided a pasty tax or another national insurance U-turn by basically avoiding any kind of personal tax hike. If you go and look in the Red Book at all the revenue raisers, they are all come from corporate taxation or clamping down on avoidance and that kind of thing. He has, and I think this tells you something about this. This is the budget of a Chancellor who knew he could not afford a single mistake. He knew that if this budget went wrong, that would probably be it for him. Because for one budget to go wrong could be considered misfortune. For two budgets to go wrong in a row looks like carelessness. And a Chancellor can't afford to be careless. So if you go through this, I mean, you also saw something about his political mood. Is he was talking about a change in the taxation of corporate-supplied diesel vehicles. And he turns around and looks up at the press gallery with a kind of mix of pleading and panic in his eyes and says, and I'd just like to stress to headline writers, this won't affect white van man or white van woman, so please let's not have any headlines about that. And I don't think I've ever, in my 10 years of sitting in that seat, watching Chancellor's budgets, seen them turn round and so blatantly turn to the press and say, please don't write it up this way. And I think that shows you how nervous he was. Indeed, I'm told that there were absolutely no jokes in the budget speech until last night, because Philip Hammond worried that it wasn't quite the right occasion for jokes, given what had gone wrong in March. And then I think he was persuaded that he could have some jokes, and he maybe went a little overboard on the joke front. But I think it tells you something about the mood. I think also, this was an inherently politically defensive budget. Mm. He didn't go for one big bazooka. He didn't say, right, I'm going to do something so big on housing that has to be on everyone's front page, or I'm going to produce so much more money for the NHS, but that has to be the story. Instead, he did a little bit in lots of places. So when he goes on the Today programme tomorrow morning, he'll be able to say, yes, I provided some more money for the NHS. Yes, I'm doing more to help young people get on the housing ladder. He's trying to cover all the bases and subsequently has spread himself quite thin. I also think you see him trying to avoid banana skins. I'm told that before the Treasury have consulted Tory MPs more closely on this budget than on any previous budget. Because again, they knew they couldn't afford for anything to go wrong. Someone in the Treasury says that seven is the magic number, because they know that only seven Tory MPs objecting to a policy sinks it in this Parliament. Because even with the DUP, they can't get it through. And I understand that until it became clear how much Tory MPs disliked it, they were going to follow through on the Office for Tax Simplification's advice to reduce the VAT threshold down to about £25,000. The fact he has chosen to leave it exactly where it is, I think, another sign of how politically nervous he is. Now, I think looking ahead, Philip Hammond's view is that this year was always going to be the most difficult year, not just for him personally, but for the economy. His view is that this is the year in which debt as a percentage of GDP will peak, inflation will peak, and it'll be peak uncertainty in terms of Britain's future relations with the EU. He himself is very bullish that you're going to get to sufficient progress at the December Council. And so by December the 15th, he'll be able to turn around and say, we've got sufficient progress to move on to trade talks, and we've got an agreement for a two-year transition. His view is that that is then going to lead to an increase in business confidence and unlock quite a considerable amount of business investment. So if you follow the logic of that, that means that growth next year might surprise on the upside. So I think, just because you can't ever discuss anything these days without talking about Brexit, I talk about the other thing, which is there's a lot of talk right now, but at the December Council, the Brexit process could be derailed by this issue of the Irish border, which is almost impossible to solve given the current position of the Irish government, which essentially would require the United Kingdom government to erect a customs border within the UK between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, which is an absolute non-starter. I mean, when you think about it, it is an absolutely jaw-dropping request to turn around to your neighbour and say, we want to economically divide yourself to placate us. So are the Irish going to veto it? Well, the first thing to note is that the Irish don't actually have a veto on sufficient progress, because the Article 50 talks take place under qualified majority voting. The second thing is, as a senior official in Dexley said to me, if the UK is generous enough on citizens' rights and on the financial settlement, the Commission and the major member states are going to turn around to the Irish and tell them to drop it. And I think the Irish are actually being slightly being played by certain people in the Commission at the moment, who are encouraging them to ramp up the border issue, knowing that ramping up the border issue means that the UK has to go further on the financial contribution. And then when they've got the extra money out of the UK, they'll then pull the rug from under the Irish. I think it is highly I think the view of the UK government is that it is unlikely that this Irish border issue is going to scupper moves towards sufficient progress. Now, in number 10, their view is that if they get to sufficient progress at this December Council, it'll be the equivalent of a political adrenaline shot for Theresa May. All of a sudden, she will be revived. She will be the strongest she has been since she made that fateful decision to call an early election. And I think as soon as she's got there, I think the cabinet reshuffle, not the enforced reshuffles that she's been forced into, but her own cabinet reshuffle will come onto the table. I mean, that is likely to take place either in December or in January. And I suppose the big question today is, will Philip Hammond be delivering the next budget? Will she move him in that reshuffle? Well, I think he's certainly helped his case for keeping his job today, because, as Andrew said, nothing has gone horrendously wrong straight away. And given that Philip Hammond can be rather gaffe-prone, I mean, there'll be a certain amount of relief about that. I also think, as Andrew and Fraser have both said, this stamp duty cut, whatever economists might say, it is going to be popular with people. And those people saying it's going to raise house prices, well, it's going to raise house prices by far less than the Help to Buy equity loan does. But the Help to Buy equity loan is one of the Tories' most popular policies. You are never going to lose votes in Britain by bungs that help people get on the housing ladder. So I think he has helped himself there. But I think it all, and I also, He went some way towards dealing with the criticism, but he is too negative about Brexit. You could hear him kind of almost straining every sinew to sound more positive about Britain's prospects outside the EU. I also think it was quite telling that he freed up the extra money for Brexit preparation. This has been, I mean, relations within the cabinet are so bad, but there were cabinet ministers who genuinely thought that Philip Hammond didn't want to spend any money on preparing for a no-deal scenario because he wanted the UK to be in a position where it would have to take whatever Brussels offered because he is so opposed to the idea of Britain walking away from the talks. But set against that is that the May-Hammond relationship is truly bad. I mean, don't be fooled by the Strepsils stunt today. They are not in a good place. Some people who've been around politics for a while were in a meeting recently where Hammond and May were talking to each other. And this person, who is not in any way naive about politics, called me up afterwards and said they were just taken aback by how condescendingly Philip Hammond spoke to Theresa May. It was in that he was basically talking to her. This is someone who used to work at the Bank of England in Theresa May. He was talking to her about economics in the way that you might talk to a 14 or 15-year-old GCSE student. And I think there is a real tension there. For their part, number 10, think that Philip Hammond makes all sorts of political mistakes. They were painfully kind of unsurprised by the trouble that his round of Sunday morning interviews caused. But ultimately, for any prime minister to move their chancellor, it is a massive, massive risk. It is very hard to think of a case in recent times when a prime minister has sacked or moved their chancellor, and it hasn't, I suppose, Thatcher moving Geoffrey Howe to the Foreign Office in 1983. But since then, you cannot think of an example of someone moving their chancellor without it reverberating on them. And I don't think Theresa May is at the moment in a strong enough position to do that. So I think he probably clings on for that reason. I think another reason why he might cling on is I think the OBR might oddly enough have helped him today. Because if, and I think Andrew is right about this, if they have been a little bit too pessimistic about productivity, there is a chance that at the next budget, the numbers are surprisingly on the upside, giving him a little bit more wiggle room. And so I think when we gather back here next year, I suspect it is more likely than not that it will still be Philip Hammond holding the red box. And I think he might have a little bit more headroom to play with than he did today.
Thank you, James. Fantastic. I'm going to take some questions. Now, just before I do, let me just spell out, I act here as a reporter, not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing with what I'm about to say. I spoke to Downing Street tonight. This is their dream scenario. They get through this budget without a cock-up or without it unravelling. They think that's job done. As things stand tonight, maybe it is. The detail has a habit of unravelling as the days go on, but they think that's done. The next thing they think they can do is that the money they are going to offer the European Union at the December summit will be accepted, and that will bring the first round of the talks to an end. They think they have organised it in a way that it doesn't keep the bargaining going, that they will not offer it until it has been accepted in the first place. So they think that's done, and then in the new year, they go on not to talk about money or EU citizens or other things, but to talk about the future relationship between the UK and the EU, which takes you into trade and defence and security and intelligence and so on. And they think that's much more positive ground. They believe if all these three things fall into place, Mrs. May, as James is saying, is through the winter and into the spring. Now, that's what they think. It does mean almost everything has to go right for them. It also hasn't yet taken into account the political crisis currently going on in Berlin as we speak tonight, and whether that's a plus or a minus. I raised this with Downing Street, and they said, but she has not been helpful. And that's probably true. There may be a bigger problem in that you now cannot get her attention, because she is struggling to try and put together a coalition. So There are lots of events that could impact, but I simply say to you, that's how Downing Street sees their sort of dream winter unfolding and how they get through it. Now, some questions. We've got a microphone there with Natalie. We've got another one. We've got another one there as well. So, sir, we'll take you there and then keep your hand up. We'll get a microphone to you as well. To the lady there. Hello, hello. Microphone there. But you first, sir. Yes.
Hello. My name's Charles Pender. I wanted to just take up on this productivity point. I know Andrew obviously said that, you know, the relationship between productivity and economic growth is fairly fuzzy as to what they're assuming. But is that, in fact, the main reason, is it believed, why these growth forecasts have gone down? And if so, bearing in mind that they're still assuming that middle path on your fan, which is actually above on the productivity growth that we've actually had since the recession, is there actually a danger that this will have to be downgraded again?
Two good questions. It is the main reason. There is an unspecified amount of Brexit uncertainty factored in as well, which they had already done in the March downgrade of growth at the OBR. But they say the main reason is their decision to reduce their productivity expectations because they have consistently overestimated the productivity estimations. But if they are right, and my questioning is the wrong path to take, it could be worse. Because what they've done is they've taken a middle. You're quite right. They've taken about 0.7% of productivity growth, but they're still assuming some productivity growth, whereas recently there hasn't been very much at all. So that is not what we've seen, is not the worst case scenario. Actually, the worst case scenario, according to the IFS, results in a budget deficit of $60 billion in 2022, which is even bigger than we have now. So it's not the phrase, and we don't add anything to that.
Yeah, no, the IFS do break down what proportion of our downgrades come from what. And for other factors, like, for example, immigration is projected to be down quite a lot, partly as a result of Brexit, perhaps not. We're also expected to die a little bit earlier than they thought as well. So there are going to be, you know, for one reason or another, fewer people to generate growth. But that's, you know, but the big chunk of it is productivity and therefore made up. It's just their estimate. The funny thing is the biggest fiscal part of this budget comes from some guy in a room changing his estimate on what things are going to look like in 10 years' time.
And it is down to one person who's just taken over this job and has a different model of productivity than the previous person in the OBR. That's what happens when you set up independent agencies. Yes?
Are nurses going to get a pay rise? They've got $40 billion to give to the EU, but no pay rise for the nurses and doctors.
I think Philip Hammond said that once Jeremy Hunt has settled with the unions, the government will fund what out of additional money to the NHS to fund whatever pay rise is agreed.
That's the what the budget said today. It did not announce a figure or what the pay rise would be, because that's not the job of the budget or even the Chancellor. But the Health Secretary is now in discussions with NHS staff, including nurses. The pay cap is gone. That's over. There's no question about that. What the size of the pay rise will be, that's still up for negotiation. But the Chancellor was quite explicit today. He said, in addition to the extra money he announced, not as much as the NHS asked for, but more than had been planned, in addition to that extra money, when the pay rise is agreed, that will be funded in addition. It won't come out of the money that's already been announced. So, I mean, I think it's been pretty tough recently, but it's better than nothing. It's the best I can do. There's a lady down here looking very insistent, and there's a gentleman there. If we get a mic to you, and then I'll come to you. There we go. Yes.
Thank you. How can the UK born and bred, humble, agile, nimble entrepreneur benefit from this recent budget?
Who are these people you talk of? I've never met anybody like that.
Yes, you have.
UK born and bred, humble, hardworking.
Dog owners.
No, I don't. I think you're fantasising. There's actually not much in this for business, is there, James or Fraser?
I mean, there's a bit of money for patient capital. I mean, the increase in R&D spending will be good for that. And there's some, I mean, basically, if you want to set up if you're a technology entrepreneur based outside London, this is quite a good budget for you. Because there are a whole bunch of, they've got this thing in East London called Tech City that has been very successful.
And just when you say about technology, if you have an online business that doesn't trade with a physical shop, is that classed as what you're talking about?
I would imagine so, but I'm not a tax expert. So
you need to speak to your accountant.
But the bottom line is there is not really much in this budget for anybody, you know, British-born entrepreneur or nurses or whoever. I mean, actually the nurses might get something, but everybody else probably won't, really. I mean, that's the bottom line. Sorry.
I mean, business's main hope was just... do no damage.
Yeah.
That was all. They were not looking for anything very much. He did not stop the cuts in corporation tax, which at one stage there was talk of that. He's going to continue, because that would have gone on to Labour territory and spiked their guns a bit. He's going to continue to cut down to 17%. He's made some rather beneficial changes on business taxes. He's reconfigured business tax from RPI, which is a higher rate, to CPI, which is lower, but being Mr. Hammond, the sting in the tail, business rates are now going to be revalued every 3 years, not every 5 years. So that could push them up a little bit. And there's a few other things for business that almost nobody other than Philip Hammond will understand. I mean, I think for the kind of people you may be talking about, the biggest gain is that he did not lower the VAT threshold. Because if he had lowered the VAT threshold, it's not so much that small businesses would have to pay a ton more money, because they're basically VAT collectors, but they would have been lumbered with massive more paperwork and bureaucracy. And he didn't do that. James, I think you said that at one stage he was going to, until he was told not to.
So the Office for Tax Simplification said, let's look at the European average, we're massively high, and it creates this massive cliff edge. So... what the Treasury don't like is that there are lots of small businesses that basically stop working in December because they don't want to exceed the £85,000 threshold and have to go through all the bureaucratic hassle of filling in VAT forms. So they were considering lowering it down right down to £25,000 until basically Tory MP said, hang on a second, this is going to be completely electorally toxic with small businesses that are suddenly going to find themselves lumbered with this incredibly complex scheme. So he's left it where it is at 85,000 for 2 years. But I think they are going to... But it's quite clear that in the Treasury, in the bowels of the Treasury, they desperately want to get their hands on this. But I think Philip Hammond has been too burnt too many times to let the rational minds of the Treasury at it. But I think that, you know, the next Chancellor should be very wary, because buried somewhere in their box of budget submissions will be a simplification to the VAT regime that might come back to bite them.
My own view is that if Mr. Hammond had proceeded to cut the VAT threshold rate when he got home tonight into 11 Downing Street to his bedroom, by the bedside table would have been a large bottle of Glenfiddich and a revolver. Because he'd have been gone by tomorrow. Yes, where's the next one? Who's got the microphone?
Yeah.
Where are we? Who? Sorry. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. My name is Sumal Fernandez from Market Harbour. But two questions. The one is, I'm quite worried about the pessimism Fraser mentioned about the 300,000 houses. I can't see any reason why we cannot build them. But that's not the point. Second issue is that has the time arrived for National Health Service not to be a party political animal, because we pride in ourselves with the National Health Service, and that I remember in 2015 elections, there was a leaflet going round in Cambridge. There was only 72 hours to save the National Health Service by, it was produced by the Labour Party. So has the time arrived for all the parties to get together and show some solidarity to save our National Service, Health Service?
You are aware who leads the Labour Party, yeah? And you think they all go around the same table, James?
No. George Osborne was always very keen on this idea, because the way he thought about it was, Labour, by giving the Bank of England independence, had taken away a Tory issue. So he would quite like to give the NHS independence to take away a Labour issue. I don't see how that happens. I think it is simply too large an item of expenditure to hand over somewhere else. I also think if you look at Simon Stevens and how much money he wants, at some point we actually have to have a national conversation about what we want to fund out of general taxation. Because the nature of a health service is it could swallow up ever more money. You know, Simon Stevens is basically says it could take £350 million a week now and it could use it. It could probably do good things with it. But we have to have some national debate about what we want to fund, how we're going to pay for it with an ageing society, and what we want to do about social care. And I mean, these are really big conversations that we have to have as a country. And, you know, look, in a way, when Nigel Lawson said that the National Health Service was the nearest we had to a national religion, he's right. But I think we are, at some point, the demographics mean we are going to have a very difficult conversation about what we're going to pay for and how we're going to pay for social care.
And social care wasn't mentioned by the Chancellor at all today.
No. They've kicked the social care white paper, which was meant to be produced before Christmas, is now not coming until the summer of next year. It's on Damien Green's desk. So there are some
along with
there.
A few other things on Mr. Green's desk.
Yeah.
Very well. I hope we don't pick up the wrong document and by mistake.
Can I pick up a point on housing? So you were saying that... that we're being pessimistic because we're aware of the housing thing. Here, there
yeah,
we are.
There you
right. Are. You know, I mean, that is the situation so far. 300,000, that's a long way away. Now, if we were to get anywhere near that dot on the end of the table, you'd have to eat into the green belt. And they had this discussion recently. And Theresa May personally, rather than Philip Hammond or anybody, is the block saying, no, 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 the green belt is absolutely sacrosanct. You're not going to... I mean, 5% of the green belt would probably do it, but 5% or even 0.5% is not up for negotiation. You need a prime minister with... You need a government a little bit more committed to this than the Conservatives currently are. They're divided, they're stalemate. So right now they're coming up with the trick, which I've heard too many times. Oh, every manifesto of every party says we're going to build hundreds of thousands of homes. I don't think Gordon Brown was insincere back then when he promised 240,000 and then saw it plunge. It's just very difficult to do politically because central government doesn't decide it. It's all the local authorities who can deny planning permission. And unless you've got a national agency that's going to overrule them, which Sajid Javid is trying to come up with, then I don't think you're going to get the step change. And it really would be a step change to go from where we are now to where they want to be.
For the good of the country, the next Prime Minister needs to come from an ugly constituency. Because David Cameron and Theresa May...
From an ugly constituency?
Yeah, but the last two Prime Ministers have come from these beautiful... Greenbelt-dominated Oxfordshire constituencies, and they just don't want to build houses because they think, oh, it's so lovely. We need someone who comes from somewhere, you know, a pig-ugly constituency where they don't mind building.
Scunthorpe. Time, Scunthorpe, and the Prime Minister. There's a gentleman there, and there's a gentleman right at the very back as well. Well, actually, give him to the... Give it to that chap there, because he's there. Yes, sir, we'll go to you first.
Can I ask James... on the reaction of the opposition to today's budget. On the television, they looked to me very glum as the budget went through, and I was slightly surprised.
The Tories looked a bit glum.
The Labour Party looked glum.
Oh, they looked glum.
I would say the Tory party looked relieved.
Reply,
yeah.
Which I think he wrote 3 years ago.
Sorry?
It did go on, and he did lose the attention of the House on both sides, but even his own side...
I mean, the Labour benches looked a bit glum because they were hoping for lots of targets to attack. They were hoping that there would be lots of tax rises that they could go after. But because Hammond essentially chose to borrow the money, they can't do that. And it would be the pot calling the kettle black in the extreme for a Corbyn-McDonnell Labour Party to attack the government for borrowing too much.
Good point. Yes, sir?
My name's David Taylor. James, you mentioned that... Hammond escaped possibly today and highlighted that he's made a couple of foibles before in terms of the poor jokes he actually made at the last budget. John Major, I think, sacked one of his chancellors and replaced him by Ken Clark, and that was a pretty good decision. And on Hammond's performance when he was Secretary of State for Defence, when he said, a spreadsheet fill, I've sorted out the budget.
Can we get a question here rather than a history of Tory cabinets?
What is his chance of surviving after the winter?
I think you've answered that already.
Well, I would say that John Major replaced his chancellor and then lost the next election. The Labour Party won 179 seat majority. So I'm not sure it worked out for him too well.
You think he'll still be here next year, don't you?
I think he's got a better... I think as long as he doesn't make any more cock-ups, he has. I think one of the things in his favour is that appointing... So when Theresa May became Prime Minister, she said, oh, I'm going to appoint Brexiteers to all the key Brexit departments, and that's the proof I'm going to deliver it. What she either didn't know or didn't say is actually the Treasury is the most important Brexit department of all. And so I think there are lots of Brexiteers who would love to put a lever in that job. I think Theresa May will be reluctant to do that because it would upset the internal balance of a Tory party. I think if you were looking for someone who was acceptable to both Leavers and Remainers, you'd probably end up with Jeremy Hunt. But I think that Theresa May will worry that if she did sack Philip Hammond, he would do a Geoffrey Howe. He would go to the backbenches and he would just set out all of his frustrations with her. And she's still so weak after calling an election, which everyone thought she was going to win easily, and blowing it with a manifesto that went so wrong. But I think if you had her former chancellor go to the backbenches and denounce her, it would be very hard for her to survive that. And for that reason, I think that they are mutually assured destruction keeps them both in place.
There you go. Yeah, we've got one up there. Nats, have you got a mic? Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That's a microphone in your hand.
It is. Nice slides. Thank you, Fred. My name's
Victor
Hill.
You need to hold it up to your mouth. That's how it works.
I just feel there's a downside risk that nobody is talking about, and that is the interest bill on the national debt. I mean, we've just had a hike in rates from 0.25% to 0.5%.
There's no point having a mic unless you use it.
No, I think the mic's a wee bit dodgy, but I can hear you, sir.
Yeah, rates are heading up. Yeah. There's no question about that. Now, if interest rates were to regain historically normal levels, quotes unquote, you would have an interest rate of maybe 3 to 5% on a total stock of national debt of heading up to 2.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. That would create an interest bill. Thank you. I don't know if you've got the slide there.
I do, just as you mentioned it. It's all going to be...
Which would be enormous. I mean,
censor that one, obviously.
That's the future of the economy.
We know that...
we get the point.
Yeah, the question is, how do they survive a debt mountain in an age of rising interest rates?
I'll give you a quick... You're right, sir. Right now, the biggest variable in this whole economic gamble is what if interest rates go from being 0.5% now back to the... 5% used to be a normal rate. It used to be regarded as neither stimulatory nor depressing. And if that were to happen, I don't know how many of us here have got mortgages where we're paying less than 3% interest rate on. If that would be doubled to 6%, all that would go wrong. The answer is that right now, interest rates have been going down world over. It's not just a British phenomenon. And when the markets assess where rates are going, they think, yes, they will go up, but the OBR, I didn't put out the slide today, but they assess that in 6 years' time, maybe seven, the interest rates will be at 1% rather than 0.5%. Mm. So that they're going to peak, when they do peak, at something like 1.75, 2%, and then stay there. So nobody anywhere in any country is imagining interest rates going back to where they were. However, nobody anywhere in any country imagined we'd be looking at interest rates as low as they were. So things can change quickly. And right now, there's a massive gamble being taken by Hammond today because he is not... I mean, the OBR has got this line saying that in any five-year forecasting period, there's a 50-50 chance of recession. Now, we haven't had a recession in this country for quite some time. We're overdue one, Brexit or no Brexit. And if we do have one, as the OBR said, there'll be a lot less manoeuvre to borrow extra money because they're borrowing so much. So what you see behind me is a big gamble on the idea that A, the rates don't go up significantly, and B, there is not a recession because the odds of one happening are, reasonably high.
It is a gamble, but it's a gamble that every Western country is playing. We're not in this alone. The current cost of debt servicing is about £46 billion. That means that we are paying in interest the equivalent of the total defence budget already, even with low interest rates. It's 10 billion more than the total transport budget. And that's just on debt servicing, just paying the bondholders their yields. It will rise. It will rise because interest rates have already started to rise a little bit. It will also rise because inflation has risen, and a fair chunk of our national debt is in index-linked bonds. So that makes it more expensive as well. But I think the rise in rates is going to be very slow. It's being led by the US Federal Reserve, and it's being very cautious. And I'm not sure that even though the bank, in effect, only in this country, reversed the 25 basis point cut it made after the referendum, that's all it's done, that I think when you look at these growth figures now that the OBR is saying, it ain't going to be in any rush to raise interest rates again very soon. The US Federal Reserve is talking about, it desisted from one in November, there may be another small one in December, and its forward guidance for next year, we don't know. We've had no forward guidance from the Bank of England next year. The ECB is not about to start raising rates. The Bank of Japan hasn't started to do that. It is merely cutting the amount of QE. So I do take your point. I think it's a strong one, but I don't think it's an immediate danger at the moment. A couple more questions. Yes, lady there, and the gentleman down here. So, you got two. How did you manage that? You got
I'm
two.
I'm not sure.
Very clever. Right. Well, pass it along. And there's a gentleman in the striped shirt here. Yes.
I would just like to know, did they change any regulations in pensions, VCTs, or EISs today?
EIS they did, I think, a bit. But pensions they didn't. It had been one thing they thought they might do. VCTs was another. Now, here's the thing. I can't answer that definitively for this reason. Not every major measure is actually in the budget speech. Quite often. Gordon Brown used to do this all the time, but George Osborne was not averse to it, and Mr. Hammond certainly isn't, that actually when you get the full budget documents, which are this thick, you find things he didn't even announce. But what I can tell you is he didn't mention the VCTs in the speech, and he didn't mention any changes in pension. We thought he might do something because there's a lot of money in pensions there. He didn't do that. There was a technical change on the enterprise allowances, but I don't know what it is. You'll have to wait for the morning papers, I think, for that. Yes, who's got the mic? Yes, sir.
I just wanted to ask: is the stamp duty change that doesn't affect Scotland? Is that likely to cause
no.
a headache for it, the Scottish government?
It's a good question. It does not affect Scotland because Scotland doesn't have stamp duty. Scotland has a more complicated version of stamp duty introduced by the nationalist government at a higher level and, of course, has resulted in lower revenues.
I mean, you saw... I mean, one of the fascinating subtexts to this budget is how the Scottish Tories, the influence that they have, you can call it pork barrel politics, whatever you like, but there were three specific measures in their design to help the Scottish Tories. So the VAT off Scottish emergency services, the change to the North Sea oil revenues, and the freezing of whiskey duty. And then I think you actually could almost add a fourth, which is the stamp duty change, which already you see those 13 Scottish Tory MPs standing up saying, well, what are the government in Holyrood going to do? Are they going to match this in Scotland? Are first-time buyers in Scotland going to be worse off than the rest of the UK? And I think this is going to be one of the themes of our politics over, certainly between now and the next Holyrood election in 2021, which is the government at Westminster trying to needle the Scottish government all the time, saying, look, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? You saw it today when Theresa May at Prime Minister's Question said, you know, I mean, so much for the respect agenda. We're going to bypass the Scottish government because we don't think it's competent on broadband, and we're going to go straight to councils. I mean, watch this, and I think it's going to get more and more because Ruth Davidson is the kingmaker of the Tory party right now. Yeah. And what she wants, she gets.
It is a remarkable changing dynamic in the Commons, and James is right. PMQs today obviously doesn't get much publicity because it's a precursor to the budget, which makes the news. But the whole dynamic of the House has changed for the government, because there are now 13 MPs in the House with Scottish accents, and they're Tories. And suddenly there are these people getting up, pointing at the Scottish Nationalists, saying they're useless at broadband, they're useless on the health service. And from zero MPs, effectively, I think one for a while, zero for one, then one, suddenly it changes the whole dynamic, and it puts the SNP much more on the defence, because it's not some posh Tory from the home counties that's having a go at them. It's someone with the same sort of accent as the SNP MPs. And it's really, it's been fascinating to watch. There's a lady here, and we'll have one more from somewhere up there. Yes, a gentleman hesitant, but you got your hand up, so we'll get a mic to you. Yes.
James, you've been saying that you want a bold budget.
Did you?
I'd just like to ask you, actually you both, if you could just say one thing that you regret most about today's budget.
Oh.
The thing I regret most is that there isn't proper planning reform. I don't think you're ever going to get to hit 300,000 houses unless you are prepared to actually embrace radical planning reform, which is going to involve some building on the Greenbelt. I mean, the most depressing story I wrote in the run-up to this budget was that, as Theresa May said, oh, don't build on the Greenbelt, don't build on the Greenbelt, the Treasury came back saying, well, what about we just build on the Greenbelt within half a mile of railway stations? You know, this isn't beautiful green fields. There's already train tracks running through it. And if we just did this in London and South East, it would create tens of thousands of new homes. Even that was too much for Theresa May. And I don't think you can expect people without capital to be capitalists. And The Spectator in 1922 said that the property-owning democracy was the best bulwark against socialism. And if you want to stop Jeremy Corbyn from becoming Prime Minister, you've got to build more homes, and you've got to revive the property-owning democracy. Home ownership is at its lowest level in 30-odd years. If that doesn't change before the next election, I think that the chance of Jeremy Corbyn winning will increase quite substantially.
And also, you have to build...
Hold on, I'm sorry.
...where the work is.
We're way over time, actually, and I need to get one more question. I do apologise if we need to move on. Yes, a final question, so no pressure.
Yep.
Just make
it good.
Try and
make it a good one. My question was about the mayors, because they seem to wield a lot of influence in this budget. Where they seem to get a lot of money compared to areas which don't have mayors and don't have devolved...
You mean places like Manchester?
Manchester, Birmingham...
Birmingham was mentioned, that's true, indeed. I think at one stage in the budget, the Chancellor said, and we're going to give X billion to our excellent mayor in Birmingham. Is that? I mean... So it sounds like the kind of thing that used to happen in Mayor Daley's Chicago.
This is quite deliberate from the Treasury. The idea is, if you have a mayor, you get more money. And they think this is the way to get more places to accept having mayors. It is a deliberate carrot incentive. And they'll be very happy, because lots of people in Yorkshire are saying, why didn't we get more money? Because we don't have a mayor. I also think, as Andrew says, if you elect a mayor from the governing party, you're particularly likely to get money. The Tories, to their surprise, won the mayoralty in Teesside in March, and Teesside got a bunch of money in this budget. I think one of George Osborne's lasting legacies for British politics is that we now have, you know, George Osborne's, one of the people he was most fascinated by in politics was Lyndon Baines Johnson. And we now have US-style pork barrel politics in Britain. And I don't think that's ever going to change.
Right, we're going to leave it there. I'd like to thank again Old Mutual Global Investors for being our excellent partners and making tonight possible. There is always here a subscription offer. If you subscribe to The Spectator tonight for just £12, I mean, look at you, look at an affluent bunch, £12 is pocket change to you. You not only get a 12-week subscription to the magazine, free access to our website and our apps, you get a moleskin notebook. I tell you, it was a beautiful mole that made this notebook. Here it is. My beautiful assistant is here with the moleskin notebook and the limited edition Michael Heath. Spectator readers will know what a wonderful cartoonist is. He is. That's the tote bag from Michael Heath. It's a steal at 12 quid. Clear Christmas is just around the corner. We have one more major event in our calendar of events of The Spectator this year for the public, and there's still a chance to buy tickets. It is, what is the future of the Tory party? It could be quite a short event. It's next Monday night, the 27th of November. It's at the Emanuel Centre in Westminster. Priti Patel, who has time on her hands, has just agreed to join the panel. And this time she will not be flying in from Nigeria. Please join us, and our sponsors at Old Mutual. Join us for some drinks and thank our panel before you do. Good night.